Okay, now we're good. Okay. I'm going to turn this down, and I'm going to be off to the side a little bit so I don't get so much of the S sound. Okay. And it'll be about this far from your mouth.
Okay.
And if you move, I'm going to move the mic with you, just so you know that. So I hope that won't bother you.
That'll be just fine. I could sit still.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. So I need for you to start by saying, I am Lipo Cha, and I come from, you know, whatever. And I have to do this so that I don't make noises with the mic.
Okay. All right.
Find a comfortable place there.
Yeah. My name is Lipo Cha.
You want to say, I am.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I am Lipo Cha. Originally, I came from the country of Laos, in which I was born in that country. And I pretty much say that I grew up in that country. And we left the country in about 1975, after the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam. And just so that you understand, you know, the Hmongs, particularly my parents, has also been very involved with the United States governments during the Vietnam conflict. More specifically, they have been very supportive and involved in the CIA's effort of stopping the rapid growth of the Ho Chi Minh trial in that area. And so the Hmong has been recruited to assist the United States to really help them to rescue downed pilots, and also helping them in that particular area. And I realized that coming to America, that particular story, I don't think that is very well known to the general you know, public, particularly the American people. And a lot of people are still surprised why, you know, after the fall of Saigon and after the U.S. government withdrew from Vietnam, why do we even have Laotian Hmong refugees and the Laotian refugees along with it? And just so that we can also tie that story together. So I came, let's see, I think we actually fled to Thailand as refugees. And how do we get there? In different part of the country, other people has the opportunity to fled by boat. Other people have the chance to fled by planes or by cars. But that particular part of the country, and at the particular time, my families do not have such luxury. So we have to fled by foot. And so we fled the country by foot. And it took us probably close to a month just by foot. We, you know, just go through the jungles and following trials. And it was fortunate enough that my grandfathers and my father are very familiar with the... with that part of the country, because they have been in the service, and they also know particularly the Thai authority that control the border in that area. And so how did I remember? What did I remember in terms of some of the most difficult moments, or maybe the fun moment? For us, for sure, at the time we fled the country, at the times that, you know, the new communist Lao government have not fully took control of the country yet. And so at that time, it's still an open border. So that means that, you know, we can actually fled without much of a hazard situation, but it's still very dangerous, and that you fled the country in secret. And so a lot of time you have to, depends on what area of the country. Like I mentioned, there's no, road. You may have to go through jungles and trial, just little trial. As a young boy, what I remember is that at that time, the only thing that I could carry with me is just a tiny little blanket. And even that is still very hard for me. My ankle was swollen. I think some of the kind of horrible things that kind of happen as to us as child is that, you walk through those tropical and forest jungle, and where there's a lot of leeches. Some of us knew as bloodsucker, and you wouldn't know it. And by the time my God, they already got fat, and if anywhere in your body you kind of feel cold, then you know it, leeches. And so those are some of the little things that kind of very, yucky and scary for us as young people. But indeed, we have gone through other periods that it's much more scarier, particularly if you were spotted. You could be shot at. And so in those particular area where you have to flat, or you have to walk by night rather than by days, and you have gone through some very steep hills. In one particular area that I could still remember is that it could be as dangerous as if you slip, then you're done. And we have seen particularly horses, because at that time we were able to use some horses to carry stuff for us. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to carry the food or enough materials to actually really support us to make it to where we wanted to go, and which is Thailand. And so in one instance, we have a horse that kind of slipped out of the trail, and there it was. All the way down to the bottom of the hill, and that was it. You cannot get the horses back, your materials. And so let alone the dangers of being spotted, but also the road, the trials of the jungles itself, the road to get to the Thai border or the camp is not an easy, journey either.
What was the fun time? You said something about fun times.
Well, I think the fun time is as kids, we didn't know better. You don't worry much about the danger. But rather, I think the only fun time is that, gosh, you got these, 40 or 50 people, as a group all together. And so you have a lot of kids. And, there's time that you think, oh, okay, it's kind of fun. Like you went camping or things like that. So those are some of the fun memories that you kind of thought about. But then actually when you really think back, and consciously thinking about the danger that you could be encounter any moments at any time, it's like, gosh, your life is really on the line, and it could just, take a few seconds, and anything could go, wrong, and you could be finished. then things like that are pretty scary. And of course, we have lost a couple of our cousins on the way to the camp, mostly due to illness. On those jungles, you don't have any medications, and the only thing that you could do is just pray. And if pray does not work and God does not help, then you're done. And one of the sad part is that you know, as a kid, you saw somebody pass away, and you know, you got no tools, you got nothing, and so the adult would do the best that they can to bury those that individual, and it's you know, as a teenager, as a young child, it's kind of devastating. And so some of those moments are, you know, pretty horrified and pretty scary. So that's pretty much the kind of journey from Laos to the border of Thailand and to the refugee camp.
How much school had you had in Laos before you came?
Well, I had.
How were you different from others who were not able to go to school? What was special for you?
Well, I would probably feel very fortunate as a child. Probably mostly because of my family's, you know, considered to a lot of Hmong children's. You know, many people, either by histories or by stories, many people think that Hmongs are living in the hilltop, and which, you know, those hills are not like, you know, over here, like you go to considered, you know, the mountains. Not really that kind of mountains. I think that what they probably refer to is that these people are a lot more living out in the countryside. You know, certainly, you know, if you live in the mountaintops, you're probably not going to be able to you know, access to a lot of stuff. And so truly just so that we have a better understanding. as a child, my family has, we had properties and we live in the province, I mean, mostly in the city. And so as a child, I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to actually go to a formal education or schooling in the country of Laos. I, as a young man, I almost, we left the country when I was about 12, 13 years old. In the country of Laos, if you could make it into, because the schooling system over there is a little bit different, and so you do not have a 12th grade level like over here, in which they will issue you a diploma when you are in 6th grade, and then after that you will go to more like a technical schools or you know, trade schools, and then you know, or go on to your college, you know, more related to your college type of training. And so I have some education back there, much more like what I would probably call is that, you know, almost to your high school level over here. And so one of the interesting things is that when I got here, you know, I realized that in terms of the math and in terms of the you know, science stuff, you know, it's you know, starting in high school here, it seems like, oh, okay, pretty familiar, pretty easy, you know. And so so I do have some formal education, and I feel very fortunate, partly because of the opportunities that my parents provide us as young children. And so let's see, we got to the camp. We were in the camp for I would probably say close to 3 years. And we didn't know better. You know, when we got there, particularly my parents always think, well, we're only here for temporary and we'll be returning to our homelands. You know, probably it's just a matter of time. And, you know, we probably try to ignore the reality, I must say. And the reality is that, you know, we know that when, you know, any kind of treaty happens or when any kind of political change, it's going to take some time to really, you know, see new policies and changes. And so we kind of stayed in the camp for almost 3 years in the refugee camps. And, you know, the refugee camps are not something that many of us could imagine. You know, at first, you have a little bit of flexibilities. But then when you really got put into the refugee camps is where it's all fence. And you don't have much freedoms. You don't have much flexibilities in terms of getting out from the camps and that. Can you imagine? I mean, 18,000 people live in maybe, you know, at most, this little tiny camp, you know, just a lot of people probably have never seen it before. And, you know, these camps, you know, you just live in this type of bamboo tent is what I call it. You know, many people refer to like house or things like that, but I wouldn't call it house. You know, it's just more like, you know, your little space. And families after families, they just crawl into this little space. At first, when we first got there, I think every family tend to able to actually brought some cash with them, or maybe some goods or some, you know, silver goals with them. And, you know, after a while, you kind of, because there's no other ways to actually make any monies or raise any kind of funds or, you know, grow anything. And so for that reason, whatever you had, you're going to spend it all out just for food and raise your families. Even though the U.S. government have been very helpful in terms of contributing aids and things like that to the refugee in the camp, but those are not enough. And so, you know, I remember because the hope of most of the elderly people and the parents are, you know, thinking that, you know, soon one day we're going to be able to return. And so we kind of keep staying there and waiting to see whether or not we could actually return. We, you know, slowly but truly realized that that is something that is not going to be possible. And so our family decided to resettle in the United States. We came to the state in 1978. And, you know, before we came over, because of the involvements and the type of service that my family had provided to the U.S. government, we had the opportunity to actually be resettled in the U.S. much earlier than 78. But then, you know, many of them kind of feel, well, okay, we wanted to wait and see whether or not we can go back. And so sure enough, we wait there long enough when you're all dead broke and don't have any other ways to live on besides the, excuse me, besides the aids that, you know, the U.S. governments and all the Thai governments that were able to provide us. And so at that time, the family decided to resettle in the U.S., which my family came to the U.S. in 1978.
When you say your family, how many people are you talking about? And are you talking about a whole group of Hmong people, or are you talking about only your immediate family?
I'm talking about my immediate families. That means my mom, my dad, brother and sisters. And because when you were processed overseas to resettle in the U.S. or Austria or, you know, France or anywhere, you know, like in Canada or somewhere else in Europe, you know, even though you may have huge extended families, but truly you will just be considered and registered in process just with your immediate families. So when I refer to families, that means your immediate families.
And what had you heard about the United States before you came here? What kind of stories did people tell you?
Well, you know, for sure, coming from Indochina to the Western world, it's something that it's a lot of unknown. And honestly, I must say that some of the stories that we have heard before we arrive are very scary. And, you know, one thing that I must share with you is that it's somewhat funny in a way, but it was funny when we arrived and realized the reality, but it was so scary before we arrived. And as a matter of fact, this kind of story, even scare some of the refugees in the camp that do not want to come. And some of the story were like, you know, in the West, we do have monsters. And, you know, when you come over, you can be eaten by monsters. And so these kind of things, for sure, you know, we didn't know better. And so, you know, those that who have some basic, families that have some basic educations and knowledge of the world, it's much easier for us to say, but particularly those that who may not have any, good understanding or knowledge of the world, then it's very hard. And so do the West have monster? I mean, in the United States, do we have monster? Well, not really. And so those are some of the stories that we were told before. But some of the funny thing is that for sure, you know, you're coming from a, countries that I would say a undeveloped country to a very developed country, then that's a huge, huge change. And just for example, basic living, it's something that you have to learn all over. Just for example, we do have many refugees, and even our families that when we came over, as basic as how do you turn a stove on, how do you deal with electricities, and that kind of things. And so these are some of the basic challenges that our family have to face, and more just basic living over here. How do you make a living? How do you start a life? It's really something that it's very foreign to us, to our families, and in general to many refugees. So for us, what are some of the things that kind of funny and or scary? Well, I must say that when you first came over, let alone the language barriers or the cultural barriers, do you know your way around? It's a scary thing. Didn't know where the bus going to take you. I remember in the early days, many of us get lost around towns. When you get on the bus, you don't know how to get off, and when you trying to get off, you don't know where you are. And so we do have many horrible stories and experiences trying to adapt and trying to adjust and trying to learn.
What about the area where you and I met, which was at Roosevelt High School? What was that neighborhood like for the Hmong people who lived there, and what kinds of problems did you run into?
Well, if I were to think back, I probably believe that I may be one of the very first Hmong students that went to Roosevelt. I remember that there were three other Vietnamese students that they have attended Roosevelt before I did. And during those days, I must say that one thing that is very different in the educational system, you know, attending Roosevelt, I didn't know better. You know, where I came from, you know, the classes, you remain in one class. And in different hours, different subject will be taught to you. But over here, every hours, every period, you go to a different class with a different subject. And so I can tell you that was one of the most challenging for me. How do you go to, you know, room 220 to, you know, room 29 or 109 or, you know, one part of the corner to the next part. I mean, one part of the building to the next, one room to the next. And so that is one thing that I have to learn quickly to adjust. Well, in terms of the environments of the neighborhood there, I must say that during those days, we do have some difficulty. And you're not to be very harsh, but I believe that during those days, we do have some racism going on, and we do had some difficulty.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, I think one of the examples that I remember is that during those days, we had a lot of fight between our you know, Asian kids and our you know, Caucasians or African American kids there, and partly, probably one of the things that would difference. You know, we've been calling names. We've been shot at. You know, I remember one of the cases that one of my friend got shot with a BB guns. And then, you know, the Hmong community in that area also got harassed. They got beat up. And in one incident that I remember that I have to call the cops and dealing with, you know, we actually have, you know, some, you know, other kids from other race that actually came over and threw smoke bombs at the apartments close to Roosevelt's, and you know, we've been egg, and we've been, you know. One of the interesting thing is coming from Indochina, throwing eggs at somebody's house or anything like that. We didn't know what is the meaning of that, you know. So we thought, "What egg?" You know, where we came from, we threw rocks. Not what happened here. Well, for sure, we learned that. Wow, goodness, you know, if you really don't like somebody, you egg them. Well, okay. So those are some of the things that we have encountered and that we have to overcome, but which, you know, and also as a young person, I remember that we went to town hall, talk about this kind of conflict, do assembly, trying to promote cross-culturals and those kind of things. And so these are some of the issues that we have to, you know, overcome.
I remember that you helped the North Portland Youth Service Center do a bilingual bingo where we had people from the Caucasian community mix with the Asian community, and then we had a fair. Weren't you involved in that?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think that's one of the social service organization that I probably have first experience in terms of involved in the advisories and also involved in some of this planning. And yes, indeed, I have involved in that. One of the interesting things that at that time, I probably think that we do had around 5,000 to 6,000 Hmong in the city of Portland. And we have so few people that who is able to speak the English language. And so I remember that, yes, we have to do a lot of troubleshootings and, you know, organizing our parents and working with communities to, you know, solve problems and how to actually work together to understand, you know, one another and to also have a better understanding of each other's differences. I think one of the events that I you may refer to, one of the bingo halls or one of the activities that we did was, I think, combined with a potluck or some sort of activities. And I think during those time, it was Congressman Ron Wyden that I think came over and gave us a talk. And so those are some of the activities that I think that has been very productive in terms of helping to solve problems and you know, bring communities together to understand each other's and find solutions how to best work and overcome or help to solve some of these conflicts.
How well do you think the Hmong community in Portland is doing these days? What kind of problems do they face? And what are their big successes?
Well, I must say that if I look at it, Hmong communities in the city of Portland have come from a long way. And, you know, one thing that today we kind of knew much better of what we have gone through in terms of the integration process. You know, during those days, I must say that, you know, I used to call it, we are in our honeymoon stages. And, you know, we do not have to worry about gun sound. We don't have to worry about, you know, whether or not you're going to be arrested for what you say, what you believe. And so even though we are so poor, even though we don't have anything, you know, you still very much enjoyed who you are, what you are, and you know, even though you don't have much money, you don't worry about it because, you know, I think during those days, everybody said, oh, you know, there, America is the lands of opportunities and the homes of milk and honey or whatever that, you know, people always refer to. And do we even know what that is? I mean, see, for a lot of people, when they came here for economic reason versus, you know, political reasons of flat because of fears of persecutions, yeah, I think they understand what the American dream is and, you know, the lands of, you know, milk and honey. But, you know, for us, we didn't know better. All that we do is, hey, okay, you know, we don't worry about the gun sound. You know, you may not be arrested. You may not be killed. So we are in our honeymoon stages during those days. Now the integration process for Hmong. I must say that Oregon is one of the states that I would probably say that we have the highest working class Hmong people in Oregon. And, you know, during the 80s, late 70s and during the 80s, I know that economically, Oregon has gone through a huge recession. You know, you're going from a very rich timber industry to very much, you know, transitioning to other industry, like the high tech, trying to become a high tech and try to attract other business into the state to replace the timber industry. And, you know, during those time, I would say that Oregonian unemployment rate between Oregonians probably about, oh my gosh, probably ranging from 8 to 16% at that time, and among Hmong, I would probably say the unemployment rate, it's very high, probably in the 80s, and so I remember fighting for dishwashing jobs, you know, cleaning jobs, janitorial jobs, and or horticultural type of jobs. You know, we don't have it. But today, I must say that, you know, during those days, a lot of Hmong families are struggling. But today, I think they're all employed. You know, they have their own homes. And I would say that we may not quite, you know, living the American dreams yet. But, you know, we are getting to the, you know, what I call it is, you know, very much the working class folks. And so we slowly becoming self-sufficient ourselves, and of course, not locally here, but I think that if we look at across the country, Hmong has been doing very well economically and, you know, academically as well. And so, you know, just looking at, you know, the 80s, where you look at high school, I mean, college level education, very limited. But today, I think nationally, among the 200,000 Hmong population in the United States, we had 8 or 7% college level education. You know, I think we're making progress. We're not there yet, compared to the whole 13 million, API population, which is, we had a 25% college education success for this population. So I think compared to that particular percentage, I think the Hmong population still have a lot of, hard work ahead of them, and they still need to grow quite a bit, before they catch up to the general populations.
Let's look at you for just a minute. What kind of a future do you see for yourself, and what are some of your own personal dreams?
Well, for sure, I'm going to be, and I am an Oregonian, and I'm going to continue to be an American. One of the interesting things is I always dream that one day I'll go back home. But in the 90s, I have the opportunity to actually went back and visit the country. And then I came back and I said, well, okay, maybe Oregon's my home. And maybe I'll go back, overseas as a visitor rather than, considering me going back home. But
why is that? Why do you feel that way?
Well, one thing is that I know for sure that politically it's impossible right now. At first, I think it is easier to listen and to read history about those political differences or some of those structure. But then when you go back, I thought that I'm always so Asianized, and every chance I got, every chance I speak about cultural, cross-cultural issues, I always think that I'm so Asianized and I'm quite indirect, and I'm, not as aggressive, and I'm not quite as direct. But then when I went overseas, oh boy, I found out that I'm too Westernized. And so, again.
Can you give me an example of how you realized you'd become really Westernized?
Well, for example, my way of communicating, back there, indeed, I still have the respect, but I do not, I realize that I do not and I cannot not be very vocal. And so I am a lot more vocal than I should have. And so that is one of the examples where I think that I'm too direct and I'm too, Westernized. Because over here, you were taught to not to be quiet. Silent means you agreed, and silent means you don't know. And so, going back there, you kind of try to apply that kind of meaning and those kind of principles and those kind of values to the way you communicate and the way you interact with other people. And then that's where I refer to myself as, wow, goodness, I'm very Westernized. And so, for example, one of the things that, before you do business with somebody, you ought to take a little time to learn about that person before you even talk business. And I realize that when I go there, I tend to apply the Western, culture too much to it. Time means money. Okay, get on to it, So those are some of the things that I realized that, well, my goodness, I'm not that person that I thought I am. Yeah.
And dreams for you?
Well, dreams for me, for sure, you don't know what the future will hold, but certainly I would like to very much continue to be able to support my communities. And interestingly enough, I've been in the human service field, a social service field for the last 24, going 25 years. And partly probably because of the passion that, I didn't know that I have that kind of passions until recently. But for sure, my family have a long history of working with people. And so maybe I got one of those little genes, but anyhow, continue to be helping and to support my community, particularly community that I can make a difference with, particularly helping with our young children, our families, the people that who are struggle. And that is one of my passions. And, even though, someday I would love to get into, some sort of business in the future. But anyhow, I think for now, what I know is that I will continue probably going to be in the human service and working with the different people. It's one of the things that I'll probably continue to do.
And tell us what you do.
Currently, right now, I'm working with the Asian Family Center as a manager, and we do have different, Asian Family Center in Urco. We do have different kind of social service programs, just so that you have an idea. Our main Urco, some of the major programs are still very much focus on refugee resettlement, and it's ranging from employment and services, employment and training services, all the way to language, translations and interpretation services to domestic violence and other youth and family services there. And so at the Asian Family Center, we do have early childhood educations, early childhood developments and parent education type of programmings, focusing on early childhood developments. And then go on to the youth and family services. They both, these days we refer to them as school link and school based services. And I think one of the interesting things is it's in the early days, a lot of Multnomah County programs are focusing on, I would say, the service during those days are community-based service, but today it's a lot more school-based services. And so I think it's just a different strategy, how to best, reach our communities and serve the most needed, children and families. And then we also had other programs that focusing on very delinquent youth. For example, those are gang involved and gang affected kids.
What percentage of Hmong kids would you say are gang involved?
Well, it varies so much. I would probably say that we probably have the biggest problems in the late 80s and early 90s. And, this day, I think that we are much, it's kind of quiet this day. That does not mean that we do not have those problems. We do. I think part of the thing is that many of our young people, those who are hardcore, probably been, identifies and has been arrested for whatever that they had caused, and or, I think one thing is that the communities and the police and the justice, departments probably have come to actually have a better collaborations and work together in terms of how to deal with those problems. And so, at this point, I would probably say that the problem is still there. One of the things that I probably not going to be able to tell is that, particularly now after the police actually have their own gang identification, of how, you know, they would designate and how they are identifying gangs. You know, they have certain criteria to determine that. And so, you know, I would probably, you know, say that the best way to do it is probably to refer to those designated, you know, determination process to really be able to tell how many we still have. But I know for a fact, because I live in the community, and, you know, even though we may not have those very tough young people, but, you know, it still exists, and I'm still hoping that one of these days we may be able to really help our young people to, you know, overcome those challenges that they may have.
Do you think that the gang activity is connected to poverty?
Well, many reasons. You know, if you were to go back, what really motivate a kid to join gangs, it varies so much. Poverty is one, but some, not necessarily that. In the early days, we know that gang involvement does not only happen, you know, for boys, but also for girls too. And, you know, some, they just look at that as a way to overcome their own ways of dealing with their parents. Per se, you know, I mean, that's one way to really feel that they can empower themselves, or some of the reason, you know, based on conflict among, you know, different different groups also, you know, for example, like being discriminated against may also be one of the reasons. That they're gathering together and say, okay, you know, we need to be together, and so that way we can overcome some of this. And, you know, some of those, you know, it could be a more, you know, organized crime type of, you know, motive or interest. You know, for example, those that who are into drugs, or those that who are into, you know, weapons and those kind of things. But truly, I think one of the most basic things is it could means just social, you know. Hey, I wanted to be fit in, you know. I wanted to be like, and, you know, maybe acting like them and being like them, you know, maybe I'll attract, you know, a new group of friends and this and that. And so it just has so, I mean, the reason that motivated this kid to join gangs and to be in gangs is just very so much, not truly and not purely just poverty.
Thank you so much. I'm hoping that I'm not going to have to redo this because it's pretty noisy out there, but we'll see what my producer says.
Okay.
But this was wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, Anne.